Open the door. Seek new world. In here, Security 90.3 FM from Montreal.
A rebroadcast of our show from 12th January 2022. Stay tuned to Amandla. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, back to Amandla here at CQUT 90.3 every Wednesday night on your dial with news, analysis and briefings from the continent of Africa that we don't think you'll find in the mainstream media. And for sure today, we know we have something very special. Gwen, what is on tap?
Yes, well, we're actually returning to, good evening, everybody. We're returning to a podcast by Diraja Press. So as you know, for those of you who listen to Amandla regularly, at the beginning of COVID, Feroz Manji of Diraja Press was producing a number of podcasts, activism in the time of COVID. And so we rebroadcast a number of those. We haven't really done anything from Diraja Press for quite a while. And I came across a beautiful piece that Feroz recently produced. The name of the podcast is Until Everyone is Free, Rekindling Kenya's Overlooked Histories of Resistance. And this caught my eye, Doug, because sometime last year, we participated in a book launch with Diraja Press.
Yeah.
Well, actually, why don't you, you have a closer connection to that book. So why don't you bring our listeners into what that launch was about, and then I'll bring our listeners into what we're doing tonight.
Well, Feroz Manji is from Kenya by himself, and he was interested in the Mau Mau book, the story of the Kenyan Land and Freedom Army, Mau Mau from Within, by Don Barnett. And that brought us back to Uli, our old friend Uli Gierstad. Mm-hmm. And so they actually worked together, collaborated, and got that book reprinted and republished after, oh my gosh, almost 40 years out of print. So it's an amazing, it was a very fun thing to have a book launch around that. So this is neat the way it carries on.
Right. And for people who don't know about the book, I mean, essentially what that book was a very in-depth interview with one Freedom Army fighter in particular, Karari Njama. And so it is a discussion of the whole movement and fight for freedom in Kenya under British colonialism, but very much through the lens of one particular freedom fighter in particular. So now today what we're doing is the piece that Feroz has put together is he interviews April Zoo and Stoneface Bomba about their archiving of lost or erased histories of resistance in Kenya. And it's this pair are producing podcasts on the radio in Sheng, which is the alternate language of the informal settlements in Kenya. April Zoo is a freelance journalist based in Nairobi, and Stoneface Bomba is a community organizer at the Matari Social Justice Center, as well as a member of the Matari Green Movement. So together, what these two do is they're working to reconnect with lost history, rekindle the history of resistance for young activists. And as we had discussed when we did the book launch last year, is that there so much work has been put in by various Kenyan governments since independence to quash and erase the history of resistance and to really completely sanitize any discussion about what was a revolutionary movement and was essentially undermined to create a very neo-colonial state. And that's what Kenya is today. So hats off to these two and others who are working so hard to say, no, there's actually a grand and grandiose history of resistance, and young activists need to be reconnected with that as they now today pursue this fight for true independence in Kenya. So it's a really nice piece that Feroz has put together.
Aluta continua. What? Let's listen to that piece, and here they are now.
So how did this come about? What made you produce this this extraordinary thing? Up here you can see the first episode, the website for the first episode, featuring a photo there of Pio Llamapinto. So yeah, tell me, what made you do this?
Maybe I'll start and then I'll hand off and we talk about some of the creative decisions and how this came to be. Like Feroz mentioned, this came about last year in that sort of very specific political space that the pandemic created, when a lot of people had a lot of time to think about, you know, why things happen and how power shapes our lives and how we move and everything. And as Rose mentioned, I was interviewing Stoneface for a couple of pieces related to police brutality at the time. And as Rose also mentioned, we spoke a lot about the same sort of recurring themes, which was about archiving lost histories of resistance in Kenya, histories that have been sanitized or have been erased. And so we were, you know, one day we were just talking about this. Walking down the road, we walked by City Park, which of course is where Pinto was laid to rest. Stoneface will speak more about that later, but our early ideas were quite straightforward when we think about archives. You know, we were like, okay, maybe we'll do a pop-up museum exhibition in Madar, maybe we'll do a photo exhibition, put things on a wall where people can read about, you know, Pinto or other people. But then we started thinking more, and we were wondering, what if this archive was not put somewhere in a database online or in a museum or in books or, you know, in the National Archive. But what if the archive of these histories was in the minds of people, and specifically a certain class of people, the kind of people that folks like Pinto would have fought for? So, and at the time, Stoneface was carrying around Shiraz Durrani's Kenya's Unsung Martyr, Pio Llamapinto, Kenya's Unsung Martyr. He was reading that, and so we were like, maybe we should just start with this guy, start with something small. But of course, as we started to learn more about his life and just the many, many different facets of ways in which he contributed to Kenya's fight for independence, we felt that this was worth a lot more than just one story. So then we decided to do a Shame podcast.
Oh, yeah. And it
Stoneface, tell me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you very much for this opportunity. It's very wonderful on our side. So the making of this podcast, it really impacted a lot of life, not only in Stoneface and FSU, but also community at large, you know. The essence of even creating this podcast, we wanted the people to get this information, the information that is that has been sanitized by the people who use in power. But the people doesn't want the oppressed people to get out of their oppression and to defend their right. They're still oppressing the people living in formal settlement. And as we say, the modern battle is the brain battle. Yeah? If people doesn't get this information, and information is very powerful. When people doesn't get this information, they will always not seeing the real enemy. They will also fighting each other, which I call horizontal violence, you know, until we get the full forces of directing their energy, to connect their energy and their resistance on the right channel. That's why we ended up creating a Chilibrand This Free podcast as a tool of organizing. Yeah. They say When you allow your oppressor to tell your story, they became the heroes to your story, you know. And then those people who own power, they don't want people who in informal settlement to escape the created poverty, you know, because poverty is not a natural calamity, it's a man-made. And then when we were young, the school was very, very on the forefront to direct us on the wrong channel. You know, when we were young, we get this information from our teachers, and what they were teaching us Because we were young, we didn't understand exactly what is happening, because even the media, the media's really play a very big role to lose the people's mind, to direct it on the wrong side, and to distract the people's mind. And as Malcolm X said, if we allow the magazine and the newspapers will make us love our presses, you know, because it's a modern media which is belong to the people who's in power. And then to get this really is free that we created with the telephone is free. It was never even played on a modern radio station. Like the system produced radio podcasting and everything, because they understand the power of this podcast. Even the fact that we produce it in Sheng. Sheng is a language, is a combined languages, mother tongue in Madare, in formal settlement, to create a resistance language that the people who are oppressed can understand, not the people who is not from the same community cannot understand. But sometimes the politician during the election, they can come, they usually comes in our community and try to speak the Sheng. But on our side, we need people to be liberated in the mind. We need people to come out of the oppression. We need people to speak up by themselves. And that's how we ended up creating this Until Everyone Is Free podcast, as an archive that will stick in people's mind, not in people to come and see and view like a museum or maybe archive, because even the power that, you know, history is very powerful. History, if we doesn't understand your history, we don't know where heading to. And then if you're on the forefront to direct people where to head, where they'll be going, you face a lot of challenges from the state, because the system is very broken. They can do anything to eliminate the history, you know. So maybe they can come and destroy our archive, or maybe they will bring a lot of challenges for us not to make the archive. But when we create this podcast, this archive is in people's mind, you know, is either if they want to destroy it, is either they kill all of the people who have already listened to this podcast. Let it be a massacre. But because they cannot do so, when I said it's very progressive, because the people's mind is what we are targeting, the people's brain, people to be liberated in their mind. And then the fact that we choose Pyogama Pinto, you know, In class, where I was studying in Genesis Market High School, is a church project in Madari informal settlement. I never went to a very big school. I just went to an informal school in Madari, where I schooled from nursery to form four. The history that we've been given there is very, very sanitized. It doesn't add up to any people. Doesn't add to where we'll be going, because the history is very sanitized. It doesn't talk of anything. The mention of podcast, the mention of Pyogama Pinto.
Hold on, so why do you start with Pyogama Pinto? I mean, you know, we have many heroes, in the liberation movements. There's Kimathi, there's Bildad Kaggia, there's Oginga Odinga, there's a whole range of people, all of whom contributed in their own way towards an aspiration, at least for freedom and emancipation. So why begin with Pio Pinto?
So in our school, as I was mentioning, there's a part in the history and government classes. There's a small paragraph talking of Pyogama Pinto as a good boy, very handsome boy, who ran for Kenyan athlete and won. No, but athlete. But they didn't mention of Pyogama Pinto being the first assassination happened in 1965, 2 years after Kenya got independent, and the fact that Pyogama Pinto was on the front line to fight for this country. You know. Even the fact that I came to realize that Madare was actually the headquarters of Mau Mau, and Pyogama Pinto was on the forefront to help the Mau Mau fight for this country. And Pyogama Pinto actually was buried next to Madari. You know, I was collecting the history in City Park, you know, just next to Madari. And in Madari, there's a road known as Mau Mau Road. You know, people living in formal settlement, people living in Madari, actually, they don't know an idea of what Mau Mau is, why Mau Mau Road is there. Actually, even me, before I got this information, I just knew Madari at the Mau Mau Road. It was just named to be Mau Mau Road, you know. But the moment I get deeper to this information, now I started connecting why Pyogama Pinto was buried next to City Park. And Madari, there's a Mau Mau Road, and the people living in the formal settlement doesn't have access to clean water. They usually pass extrajudicial execution. I now understand the connecting in between. Now, because Pyogama Pinto was just buried next to Madari, you know, now it gave me deeper understanding. I want to know more of Pyogama Pinto, because the history that we've been teaching in school is very different from what I learned outside. That's why I wanted the people in Madari to liberate their mind as well, as I did myself. Now we created this podcast. Yeah.
Right.
For them to understand it better.
One of the things that Gogiwa Thiong'o raised in his introduction to the new edition of what was originally published as Mau Mau from Within was that we should drop the term Mau Mau. It is what the imperialists actually called our movement, which is the Kenya Land and Freedom Movement, and I think, you know, it's Mau Mau Road is a reflection of, in a sense, their celebration of the defeat of the movement, whereas the Kenya Land and Freedom Army Road would open up a possibility that struggle continues. What's your reaction to that?
I'll react to that, and then I do want to take a step back and kind of address some things about the other question first, because I think listeners who might not be familiar with Pinto probably should probably deserve at least a 30-second introduction to this man we've been speaking about.
I wrote on this
but I completely forgot as well. My reaction to that is, yes, I've heard that criticism. I think it depends totally on who erects the monument, right? And what their it completely depends on that, and whether the etymology of Mau Mau and how it's evolved over time. You know, in the beginning, it was something that was a name given to this movement by the oppressor. And so, of course, just as you pointed out, there are things to unpack there. But if that has been, I don't know, if there's a certain extent to which that's been owned, or if which that's a name that is recognizable to people who inherit that movement, the people who walk every day back and forth on Mau Mau Road in Madari in 2021, if they recognize it for the original spirit of what the movement was, which was, of course, land. To get land back and to be able to live with self-mastery, with freedom, a specific kind of freedom, which wasn't just a abstract political national freedom, but the freedom to, you know, live on your own land and have your own family and live a dignified life, that kind of self-mastery, being able to live the stages of life that a human ought to pass through. It's a very materialist goal, and I think that shouldn't be lost. It shouldn't be sanitized or abstracted into some, you know, African nationalist movement. It was very much about the dispossession of land, the dispossession of the right to live a dignified life. Mm-hmm. And if that is what people who, you know, when they pass Mau Mau Road, that sign, walk through, you know, walking through Bondeni and Madari, if that's what they think when they see that, then who am I to say, you know, to say whether it should be, whether that term should be contested. So I think I'll just leave it at that, kind of ambiguously. Maybe Stoneface can return to that.
The changing of the name Mau Mau to our Land and Freedom Road. Actually, first of all, I can say, even the people living in the formal settlement right now, they don't even understand the term of the Mama works up actually, and why the name the road, that road Mama, you know, they have no idea at all. First of all, I could like we get deeper to this by educating them first of all, who the history of Madari. First of all, we create a very good platform for them to understand how Madari came to existence and the rich history that Madari entails. That's why we've come slowly but slowly now, and to mentioning the Mau Mau was used by the oppressors, as you said, by the oppressors to call them terrorists, radical terrorists, you know, to now to exchange the name Mau Mau to land and freedom road. I think even right now, I don't think even the people who is in power can allow that for now. Yeah, because even allowing the podcast to be heard on a media, it kind of a challenging. I don't think we can. Maybe we write a petition and take it to the government, to the Kenyan government, telling them, is high time we force the state to honor even the Pilgama Pinto and to rename the Mau Mau as a land and freedom road.
But even then, there's that piece that Wangui Kimari wrote about, you know, did the Mau Mau really win in the end? Like, and she begins this piece, which I think is published in Africa as a Country, and she begins this piece by setting the scene of that monument that was put up in honor of the Mau Mau freedom fighters, or the KPLA, actually, as what the plaque says, where we were during episode three. And she writes about the opening of that award ceremony. And you had all of these old shoshos came, you know, took a mat all the way down from Neri and were sitting in the hot, hot sun. Meanwhile, all these politicians were sitting under a tent, or all these big people. And then they launched the monument, they cut the ribbons, they did all these things. And at the end of the day, I mean, what does the plaque say? It was the Kenya Land and Freedom Army. And these shoshos who have come from Neri to celebrate, you know, being monumentalized in Uhuru Park, don't have that land back, right? Or, you know, land is still, Kenya's agricultural industry is a capitalist agriculture system that's very neocolonial in certain industries. So we need to ask ourselves, you know, what the Mau Mau fought for, or the KPLA fought for, however they choose to call themselves, you know, to what, I think the main end that we must keep in mind is, you know, the end goal of what they fought for, which is a truly decolonized Kenya, a Kenya where the land is given back to the people from which it was taken in the first place. So I still think it comes back to that.
Yeah, I mean to be fair, I mean, I think, you know, the excellent podcast series that you produced, Until Everyone Is Free. I mean, you start with pure Gama Pinto, but I think what is impressive is that you then expand that, and we learn about others who have been key in the struggle for freedom, as opposed to independence from Britain, which was never really the case. The reality is that, you know, we have a neo-colonial regime. It's a continuity of what was there before, and even the Americans in charge now, as opposed to just the British. But I think it's really important that you've done that. But do you see your task now to continue that podcast series, to begin to rekindle the histories, and to make the history alive to those who the les damnés de la terre, the damned of the earth, as Fanon would have.
Which this is totally not planned, but Stoneface is currently reading.
Excellent. Well, I mean, there's a good example, you know, of how language is used. The original title in French, Les Damnés de la Terre, is the damned of the earth. It's not the wretched of the earth, which implies a certain pity for for those who are wretched. And so I think, you know, we have to, again, vocabulary, language, all these things, the words we use are important. But I think, it's, I mean, really great that you have that there. Is your intention to have a study group around Fanon's Wretched of the Earth?
Not quite, not anytime soon. But I did want to return to this idea of using, of, you know, in line with how we can use one angle or one topic or one individual to look at all these different topics. Fanon was, or I guess Pinto was sort of a channel for Stoneface into Fanon, because the reason that Stoneface started reading this book was he started thinking about the what Fanon writes about in this book, which is how a colonial city is a compartmentalized city. And all of these ideas are connected in a way. And for, and of course, like you mentioned before, there are a lot of individuals within movements who connected, you know, and we know it wasn't as if anyone worked on a single part of the independent struggle. This is a very collaborative and also chaotic and organic thing that happened. But the reason why I think we wanted to start with Pinto, and you can talk more about this after me, is that he connected so many different parts of this. And so that's how we decided to split the podcast into each episode, was by looking at just one role that he played, but not only sort of retelling history and giving, oh, this day, 1950 something, this person said this, and then he spoke to this, and then this person did this, and they went here, and then they did this. It's about using history in a way and telling history in a way that resonates with something that people see today. So for example, you know, going back to the Wretched of the Earth and the colonial compartmentalized city, Stoneface was seeing what he is seeing in Madari, and in Nairobi, how, you know, the apartheid design of the city and how it's not changed since it was basically designed as created as a colonial city 100 years ago, and trying to understand why that is the case. How do power and capital shape that? And so in the same way, for example, in our upcoming episode on Pinto as a trade unionist, we don't just look at, oh, then he went to this and this computer house and he spoke with this and this person and they had these talks and then this happened. It's we actually focus the episode mostly on the 1950 Nairobi general strike, which I believe was probably the most significant general, like, citywide general strike. I don't know about later history, but it was massive, that at a time when wage labor had only been introduced in the country for less than half a century, workers, all African workers within the city were able, and jobless people, unemployed people, landless people, worked together to put the capital of the East Africa Protectorate to a standstill for almost 2 weeks. And we bring that up because in 2021, there's so much cynicism in Kenya around protest culture, around labor organizing, and a lot of it is for good reason, of course. We are proven again and again that it doesn't always work or that it is difficult. But we wanted to use the protest, the general strike from 1950, to show that it did happen. It was possible. History can stretch and expand the imagination of people in 2021, even though the circumstances were different, obviously, for many different reasons. And we have, you know, in some ways more advantages and less advantages than people did in 1950. But, you know, Pinto, just that one aspect of this one man was able to shed a light into, you know, labor organizing, and especially how labor organizing was completely inseparable from national independence from the British. The British weren't only the sort of administrative leaders, they were also the economic exploiters, the land stealers, you know, they were, and so these things were inseparable in a way that people seem to, I think in 2021, believe are more separable, that we can separate out politics from land, that we can, you know, talk about who's in office without talking about what, you know, what monopolies they have, or, you know, how certain industries are structured. So again, Pinto, and there were many other people, not Pinto, we just decided to start with one because we felt like he was one that was perhaps less known than others, but that this one man allowed us to explore His work and his life allow us to explore these different things. And I think I'll just add one more thing, which is that in terms of his ethos, he was a kind of leader that I think a lot of people today are too cynical to believe can exist anymore. The kind of just a total embodiment of solidarity, even to the point where he, at the cost of oftentimes his family and time that he would spend with them, barely any time that he got to spend with his daughters, but a kind of person who really committed class suicide, who crossed racial borders at a time when very few people did that, who went all in, not just writing letters to MPs in London, which he did, but also routing weapons from South Asia into Kenya for the Mau Mau. He was in the trenches, and I think it's good for especially young Kenyans who are very cynical about the leaders of today and what a leader looks like to know what another leader can look like. Actually, I think in the later episode, we say Pinto is not, he wasn't a leader, he was an organizer. So he didn't, as politicians often say today, he didn't speak for the people, he didn't give the voiceless a voice. He organized with those people behind the scenes. He never, gave any very prominent speeches, or he wasn't the person who liked to do that, but he was the person who connected people together so that they could stand in solidarity with one another, that they could have the power in their hands to do what they want and just speak in their own voice.
This is Amandla Radio at CQUT 90.3 Montreal. You're listening to the Rekindling Kenya's Overlooked Histories of Resistance Until Everyone is Free. It's a Diraja Press, so stay tuned for the rest of that interview.
If I can just add on what April has talked about. We wanted to connect the struggle, or maybe the history of what were the Mau Mau fighting for? Did they reclaim what they were fighting? They said wanted land and freedom. Yes, Kenya is free, but these people are really free. Do the land they were fighting for, do you get the land? We have just replaced the white Lord de la Mayors with Black Lord de la Mayors, as even the Matigari was in the forest and he buried his gun and knife under the Mugomo tree. And then when he went out of the forest, he saw a black man in a Mercedes Benz, and then just decided there was a kid scavenging for food in a dustbin. So he went back to the forest and dug the weapon, and he said the looter continua. So to connect everything, even the struggle in the environmental sector, the struggle in the trade unionist, the struggle in extrajudicial execution, all of it is just being caused by the broken system. They said environmentalist without a class struggle is just a deadening. So we have to get more clear the way Pio Gamapinto was doing, connect the trade unionists, connect the struggle for the country, connect the Mumenyeri. That's maybe you can define that.
Mumenyeri, this is from episode 4. It was a Kikuyu language mm-hmm. newspaper, one of the largest at the time, during that golden age of vernacular language media in Kenya. That was very brief before the state of emergency that the British administration imposed, shut them all down.
Yeah. So what am I trying to say from creating the podcast? We want to reclaim back our history and story, because it has really sanitized and is leading people to know it, And by creating this podcast and connecting with the struggle of Gamapinto, connecting with Mau Mau, going back to India, help in the struggle of Indian coming back, you just connect this struggle and see it's all been created by this. Mm-hmm. He really saw the real enemy, he connect, because even in Shiraz Duran, another book is talk about Never Be Silent by Shiraz Duran, is really explaining what extrajudicial really, how did it occur, and he said very well, during the colonial period, it was said for home guard, if he kills a Mau Mau, he will be rewarded 5 shillings from his salary. And then what's really happening in a modern way, how the likes of the serial killer, the killer cops in Madari, you know, they kill people, or they kill the innocent, or maybe they kill the young adolescent, poverty-stricken adolescent people living in the formal settlement, as to be added, and maybe to be added in the ranks. You know, they just connecting from 5 shillings now to be added more ranks. You know, if you kill more youth, you'll be called a hero. You know, the state will recognize as a hero fighting the terrorists in the Madari settlement. You know. But actually, is these people terrorists? Are they thieves? You know, what's the cause of this poverty? I call it a structural violation is created by the broken system. You know, we see every who's real enemy, and by doing the podcast, the way Pigoma Pinto was doing, we channel all the energy to one enemy. You know, this is the real enemy, not to let the spirit of liberation in the modern liberation go to waste. Like people are just like don't care. I'll come. Maybe they will come next time and steal my phone. Or maybe they'll come next time and beat me up because they think Stoneface is not from the informal settlement. They think Stoneface is from another area. You know, by coming Madari, they think he's not one of us. Then they'll attack me. Yeah, but they have to imagine we are all in the same system. We are all in the same system. No, the bringing of horizontal violence actually is what we're trying to erase. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the informal settlements have been a sort of growing phenomenon in all cities across the continent, in Kenya as well as in other countries on the continent. But we're also seeing systematic destruction and land grabbing of these settlements. We've had the struggles in Dandora and more recently Mukurukwa and Njenga. Can you give me some idea of in terms of how you're organizing, what are the ways in which you are expressing solidarity with those whose homes have been destroyed this way? What organizing is going around to try to prevent this whole splurge of land grabbing, this dispossession that is going on? Because, you know, if the economy of Kenya is known by any word, it is dispossession, people, dispossession of land, dispossession of resources, dispossession of the environment, and so on. So what organizing is going on both to prevent further destruction and dispossession of the informal settlements, and what acts of solidarity have there been from within Madari, for example, with others who have been facing this situation?
I'll let Stoneface speak on this because he's the expert. And I just wanted to add before he speaks that he wrote a piece published on the blog of the Museum of British Colonialism, which you can look online. It's all in Sheng. And unfortunately, this doesn't have an English translation, but the audience for this is obviously, like you said, the people who go through, who live in the precarity of knowing that they could be evicted anytime. And the piece basically just talks about how, you know, these demolitions are always done in the name of development, but development is only ever the development for certain people to enjoy. I'll let him speak on that. But I think you can probably also share, I think, some of the thoughts around the Madari Green Movement about belonging and about you know, claiming space and making public space in places like informal settlements where land is always contested, where it is always, you know, up for the highest bidder and never actually made available, public, ownable in a collective sense by people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Actually, before that, I would like to say in 1952, is when the first demolition happened in Madare, you know, when the British government was destroying the land, the house of the people living in Madare in search of the Mau Mau, you know. And right now, the demolition that's happening even in Mukuru is in the name of development. Actually want to say this road that's going to be developed in Madare or maybe in Mukuru. Are the people really in need of roads in Madare? Do people really need this road in Mukuru? You know, is just the same like a person say, the police in the formal settlement are there to protect us. Do we really have our banks in formal settlement that need to be protected? If even our life, someone like me having the dreadlocks is targeted by the tools of oppression according to the police because of my dreadlocks, do you think is there to protect me? Yeah. Actually, if I connect back to in the Mukuru, the road that want to be built there is not for, you know, is not being going to be used by the people living in the area. You know, is being it will be used by the people, the elite who are controlling this country, who say they're really owning people in Kenya. You know, so they'll do anything to oppress the people living in formal settlement as to get to sustain their wants. You know, like there's a road in Madare known as Outer Ring Road, and a lot of people were demolished, or the houses were destructed, and to pave way for the Outer Ring Road. And actually, the people living in Madare, do they really need that road? Do we even use the road? The road is being used by the people living in the other side of Madare to allow them to have a quick pass through the Outer Ring Road going to Jomo Kenyatta without having jams and whatever. So they can fly the people from Kenya who really need the medical healthcare, from Kenya to maybe India, from Kenya to Cuba, and leaving the people who are oppressed continue to suffer, you know. So actually we don't need this road. What we need is a dignified life.
Water.
Yeah, we need water. Yeah, we need better education. You know, not just school, we need better education. We don't need hospital, we just need a health facility, develop health facility that can cure myself and also to treat a politician. He doesn't need to destroy my house to create road for him to pass whenever I want to go to the airport so as he can take his family to the Indian for treatment. You know, we need the hospital. You know, we don't need to survive in informal settlement. We need to live a dignified life. Yeah. So the demolition that's happening in Mukuru actually is really to paralyze or maybe to distract and to bring confusion in people living in the formal settlement. There's a lot of people who are just born and raised in informal settlement. They call the formal settlement home. They don't need have actually even the matrimonial home for their mothers. We depend in the informal settlement. But the government and the people leading this country, they don't even think of that. What they think, they just think what is there for them. Because even if we can just connect what happened during the colonial period, the people living in an area like Kericho, their houses, their homes, their ancestral land were being, they were taken away for the plantation of coffee and tea that doesn't help the people even working that farm. It's going to develop and the energy and the, and it's like, they call it exploitation of workers in that farm, you know. So they evict people from their ancestral land, people to, and then they force them to work on the same land to for the coffee and whatever. And then the profit is really remaining maybe in London, maybe in the British government, and then letting the people who are working there to be continue being poor and poor, to continue serving them is like a chain, is a weird slavery here until he dies. And then there's a person who say, even the school will force that and say that guy who is being exploited there is very hardworking because he wake up very early in the morning, going to the farm, and he'll become rich. One of the five, who said he'll become rich? This exploitation will just die poor, and his people and his family will just, I call it, they will inherit the same chain of poverty, you know. And then generation to generation, we just remain in a poverty. But the people who is being exploiting us will continue being rich and richer the capitalist way. You know, actually don't need this development in the formal settlement. We don't really need them. We just, like this road, actually we have to ask ourselves, where is this road heading to? And who is going to serve them? You know, they just come there to continue with the same rotation of one, the name of development, even after 5 years, to come and elect them again, to be on that chain of leadership and continue to harassing the people living in the formal settlement, you know. So just living in a poverty, in a poverty and exploited life in the formal settlement. Yeah.
Right. So but tell me more about, I mean, what's impressive from what I understand from people I've spoken to is the Social Justice Center movement, which is it's not merely Nairobi-based. It expands beyond the parameters of that city. Help me understand, or help people who are watching this understand the kind of organizing that goes on across the different informal settlements and how that is being manifested. What is the alternative world that is being created through that network?
A second, maybe I can just start as Madare, was the mother of all social justice center in Kenya. And this was, it was started in 2015, with just a couple of few people who wanted justice in our country. And they wanted to have kind of a place where they can come and document cases of extrajudicial execution, cases of these injustices happening in a formal settlement. And then so you see, like, it was just kind of a small group of people with the passion of serving to serve their community. And but then there was also a lot of people having the same potential, but they don't know where to start, you know. So they take a lead first, and then to create a way for other people like Stoneface and other emerging justice center. And it's really doing great because right now, a lot of people, not only in Madare, but also in informal settlement, have now started organizing themselves and fighting for their right and demanding equalities in informal settlement. And I can say it was just a spark for other justice centers in Kenya. Yeah.
Yeah. What I'll add on to that is that is this point of how important political education is, because it can look like from the outside that you know, if you have a lot of community dialogues, or that you know, I include this podcast squarely as a piece of political education. You know, it's just talking, right? Like, you're just talking about things, you're talking about language, talking about history, it's just talking, you're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. But both of us believe, I think that political education is not even the first step. It's like level zero before you can do anything. Before you can organize as workers, you need to know that you are workers. You need to know what wage exploitation is. Otherwise, you'll fall into all of the, you know, the ideology of capitalism, which especially in Kenya is the water we swim in, right? You don't know what, we know it as normal because, and in the US, I say we as well, because in the US, two very capitalist countries in the world, we grow up thinking and believing things that time is money, or that the harder you work, the you know, you'll succeed, or that anyone can make it rich. You know, these are myths that keep, or that, you know, hard work, like you said, you can, a man who is exploited working every day in a farm, where his surplus labor is being pocketed by his boss, is a good person because he's working, you know, all of these things. If you don't have the consciousness to know how, if you don't have any class consciousness, if you don't have political consciousness, then of course you're going to fall into the same trap that's offered you by capitalism or by mainstream electoral politics, which is that a resident of Mazari have no power. But if you vote for this person, this big man, then he will change your life, you know, but you have to vote for the right one. And those things, once you have the kind of consciousness that not only our podcast tries to give to people, but also what MSJC, the groundwork that MSJC and the other SJCs have laid down, is is just number one, what is going on? You know, number one, open your eyes and see things, see how power is shaping this, see how capital is shaping this. Only then can you begin to start collaborating and move forward. Otherwise, you're going to fall into the same traps that people complain about every election cycle. And so I think, for example, with MSJC, like Stumpy said, it's not even been 10 years that they've been around. But in the very beginning, when MSJC was running community dialogues about police killings, people were shocked. They were like, how can you talk about this in the open? And for good reason, because there's always been retaliation. There's always been the assassination of people who have documented and looked into police killings. But now in 2021, you see, after a few years of doing this, people know, people have an idea that they should report these things, that this is not okay. You see, open street protests. There are so many protests that go undocumented and unseen and delegitimized that happens just on Mau Mau Road when someone is killed. There is resistance. There is a consciousness of, you know, that, I mean, it's not to say that people before didn't know this wasn't right, but there is a sense now that people know what their power is, even though it still just is not right. And even though the risk may just still be as high, there's a consensus, a growing consensus, I think. And within the last 6, 7, 8 years, I think the discourse just on police killings in Kenya has shifted a lot. And even though I won't say that's just the work of one SJC or just all the SJCs and not anyone else, of course, it's a huge civil society, you know, a collaborative and very, very, very long process. I think that, especially when we're talking about the people who are in the most oppressed class, political education is key.
So, I mean, the situation which, you know, the organizing and the conditions and the growth of these informal settlements is not unique to Kenya. I mean, it's across the continent. And in many places, there have been quite strong organizing going on. Perhaps the most well-known one is Abakhlali Basmojondolo, the Shack Dwellers Movement in South Africa, which now currently has a membership of 100,000 people from the informal settlements across South Africa. And I just wonder, to what extent links have been made and connections made between these movements. In Daraja, we've actually interviewed a number of those from the different movements in South Africa and then in other countries. What connections have you made, and can we be of any help in facilitating that connection? Because it seems to me that is where the real Pan-Africanism needs to grow. That is the connection between les damnés de la terre. Okay, tell me your.
Can you be doing more to connect with other people who live in the settlements?
First of all, I can say the connection between people living in the former settlement of Magari, the same challenges they're facing, is just the same as people, the former settlement in maybe in India. And then the same challenges that's happening even with Black Lives Matter in the UK is what actually happened in people living in the formal settlement of being executed every now and then. So what you could do more, the moment we just identify who's the real enemy, you know, we try to connect this, we need to connect the struggle globally, you know. Now, after understanding, we don't focus with the effect, we just focus with the cause, actually, of what really happened, what's the cause of all this problem, which is being caused by the capitalist, you know. Now we start understanding that's the real enemy, and we channel all our direction to one angle, each of being more of organizing ourselves, educating ourselves more, and really we will liberate ourselves, you know, because I do understand the people in the South Africa, the same challenges they're facing is exactly what we're facing here in Kenya, you know, the informal settlement in Kenya. So I think maybe I could even allow April even to contribute more on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To be honest, I don't know that I have much more information to add. I don't know. I think that's a really interesting point that actually hadn't occurred to me, was that this shared, not identity, but the shared politics that come from being someone who lives in an urban informal settlement, not only in Africa, but around the world, is already a strong basis for so much, you know, transnational organizing. I don't know too much about the program, but I know MSJC has done, you know, something like exchange programs or certainly collaborations with other community justice centers in the favelas of Rio in Brazil. But that's not something that I'm very familiar with. But I think that this is something that, there ought to be more of. Sometimes, I think quite often we get asked why we made this podcast in Sheng and not in a more universal language like English that could reach people globally. And so that, I suppose, Stonefitz can speak more about that, but I think with this project of, political education and of solidarity, transnational solidarity, transcontinental solidarity, there are going to be different levels of resolution. And for our, given our small team of volunteers, this is our pandemic project, and that we wanted to just do something very local, and we wanted to be very targeted in our audience. We picked a language that would actually speak to pretty hyper local, in some ways, super local experiences of people in just one country within a 50, 60 year period. So that was a choice that we made. But then I think, of course, there is very much a need for similar things that stretch across countries. I think this idea of solidarity is something that is also, in episode 4, we spoke about just this word itself and what it means, because I think it can be, if you like Stoneface grew up in Madara, you understand that there is a whole, it's such a complicated place with so many nuances and different kinds of gaps and tensions and conflicts, not only between generations, but genders, ethnicities, newcomers versus like Wakukon versus Wadwankianda. Yeah, and the different, there's so many different configurations of, or just ways in which people are not in solidarity, even within just this small locality of Madari, as complicated as it is, that I think for us, we decided to just bite off this one thing that we knew we could chew, which is like how to speak to the youth, how to speak to young people who currently live in Nairobi's ghettos, and hopefully maybe just be a stepping stone and help them become more curious about similar experiences or similar movements in other places and in other times as well.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for Amandla Radio here at CQT 90.3 this week. We look forward to bringing back more news and analysis from the continent of Africa for you next week. So that's it, Gwen.
Yes, well, just a final thank you to Feroz Manji for bringing us this podcast, Until Everyone is Free, Rekindling Kenya's Overlooked Histories of Resistance. And I encourage you to go and check out the site. It's Diraja Press. Just Google it. It'll come up. There are a number of publications on there. This is a publisher primarily, but also a number of really great podcasts. So Diraja Press. Thanks again, Feroz. Thank you, Doug. Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
Good. Great. Not bad at all. A-okay. Tickety-boo. Fine, thanks. All good. It's going gangbusters. Just great. When people ask us how we're doing, we often say fine, even if it's not always the case. If you aren't fine, say something. To get help, call Info Social 811.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to a rebroadcast of Amandla from January 22.
Sony Parapopolo is back, and in real life for its 22nd edition. All the sights, sounds, and sensations of live music. After 2 years of online adaptation, Sony is filling up the month of June with liberated music of all genres. Over 45 events and 90 participating artists performing indoors, outdoors, streamed for maximum accessibility. Record and book launches, workshops, a puppet show, a satellite Sony happening in Wakefield, Quebec, of all places, and, of course, much more. For all the goodies, check out sonyparapopolo.org. Masks will, of course, be required. For your audio program guide, tune in to the Montreal Sessions, Tuesday, May 24th, May 31st, and June 7 and 14th, from 3 till 5 p.m., the Sony crew hosts will be serving up highlights of what to expect at this year's festival. This is, of course, a CKUT co-presentation.